Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. The Associated Press reports this morning that overjoyed Afghans are pouring into the streets of Kandahar today. Afghanistan's interim leader says that the Taliban forces have abandoned the city, but he says they have reneged on a promise to hand over their weapons. The supreme leader of the Taliban, Mullah Mohammad Omar, is reported missing. Witnesses say that residents in Kandahar are carrying pictures of Afghanistan's deposed king. Others tore down the white flag of the Taliban in favor of the old flag of Afghanistan, red, black, and green. This morning, we'll try to talk a little bit about what's going on in Afghanistan right at the moment and what's likely to happen here in the near term. Also, earlier this week, after more than a week worth of talks, representatives of four Afghan factions meeting in Bonn, Germany, said that they had signed an agreement to create an interim government, and that government is now scheduled to take over on December 22nd. We have two guests with us here to talk about recent events. In the studio with me, Mubin Shuresh. He's Emeritus Professor of Education Policy Studies at University of Illinois. He's an Afghan himself and has now for many, many years been following events in that country, and we have talked with him a number of times, and we're pleased to have him here again. Also joining us from Washington, Stephen Cohen. He's a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies program at the Brookings Institution. And before going there to Brookings, he was professor of political science here at the University of Illinois, one of the founders of the program in arms control, disarmament, and international security. He's written a lot about South Asia. And if you're interested in India, I just mentioned his most recent book, which is titled Emerging Power India. It's published by the Brookings Institution Press. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, also toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Shuresh, thank you, Steve, for being here. And Steve, how are you?
Good morning. Good how to be with you? You again.
Really pleased to have you here.
I just want to mention that it's very happy to be here. And I'm sure Bill Archer would have been very happy. He's a friend of me and Steve, of course, and many other people, to see this day that's happening in Kandahar, the capitulation of this very oppressive regime in Afghanistan.
Your reaction, immediate reaction, Steve?
I certainly agree with Mubin. This is a historic day in Afghanistan history. I think there's jubilation in Afghanistan. There should be jubilation here because one of the most awful blights on the face of the earth has been eliminated or removed. And I think it's important that we work towards creating an Afghanistan which is a decent, civilized country as it used to be, and America has a role in this effort. I think it also has enormous implications for other parts of the world, particularly Iran and Pakistan, who regarded Afghanistan as both an opportunity and a serious problem. So I think this has been a great victory for American foreign policy, certainly for American military power, and I think the issue is that we don't lose this victory frittered away in one way or another. But right now, I think we should take time to celebrate.
As I'd mentioned just briefly, the Afghans that were meeting in Germany in Bonn, they had a number of days, 9 days worth of talks, and just a couple of days ago said that they had worked out an agreement for an interim government. The prime minister will be Mr. Hamid Karzai, who's Pashtun. The Northern Alliance will have a number of important posts in this government, 17 ministers out of 30, and they'll have the posts of Interior, Army, Foreign Affairs. There are some women who will be involved in the government. It seems that there was an effort to try to balance the various competing interests here so everyone would come away with something. However, he said afterward, Mr. Karzai said, the real work starts now and the real difficulties will start when the interim administration agreed to here moves to Kabul. So the question is, will it be possible for all of these various folks to work together, to get along together?
Oh, I think so, and I hope so, and I'm cautiously optimistic. This coalition was hammered together and born by the UN and the Western coalition and against terrorism. They have, in fact, when they say Northern Alliance, among the Northern Alliance, it's an alliance all of Pashtun and many, many other ethnic groups. Mm-hmm. So if one looks by ethnicity, it comes a different kind of breakdown. And if one looks by political party, it comes a different kind of breakdown. What's important is, in this particular situation, is to take care of the emergency, because there's a lot of lives and stake in peril because of winter and lack of food and famine, and of course funding to put together some basic rudimentary infrastructure for this government to be able to control, like communication and some other type of stuff. I'm also in favor of modest, not huge, international force in Afghanistan, because what we have here is a group of like-minded people. That is the Rome and Cyprus and even the, of course, the Northern Alliance and what's called the Peshawar group.
Right?
Yeah, they all are pretty much the same. The Mujahideen group, like Sayyaf and Burhanuddin Rabbani, Yunus Khalis, Muhammadi, they are all gone. The two remnant of the Mujahideen group is, of course, Dostum and Ismail Khan. And right now, the two people like Mulan Ghibullah and Agha Gul, Gul Agha Sherzai in Kandahar, that are receiving the arms, supposedly, at least they were supposed to. These are all old Mujahideen. I think that era is gone. And these are very good people, I think, very competent people, some technocrats and some others that came together. So it leaves out, of course, the big belt of the Pashtun, which among them the terrorists lived, and Mullah Omar lived. So Karzai, who lived most of his life outside of Afghanistan, comes in, and he belongs to this northern, from the Oruzgan area, among the large group of Pashtun. So Kandahar, he taking Kandahar, although he's not really, but being there, that try to rehabilitate the Pashtuns in this part of Afghanistan.
Maybe, Steve, you could pick up on that and talk a little bit more about Hamid Karzai, who he is, and his potential for being a leader and being able to bring all of these people together.
Well, I would defer to Moby and Sharish about that in a sense, but Karzai is has had American experience, but he did go back earlier, even before September, and tried to establish contact and brought some fighters in with him. And I know he had extensive contacts with officials in the U.S. government, and I've talked to some of them very recently. They regarded him as a very courageous and very sensible person, and a man which we did not support directly, but certainly very pleased to see him emerge as future Prime Minister of Afghanistan. I think, and I certainly followed Mobin's description with fascination, interpreting it perhaps for an American audience who doesn't know much about the details of Afghanistan, which would include me, I think. I think what's happened in Bonn is the equivalent of an American political party accommodation, where the Republicans or the Democrats sort of pull together the different branches to put together a ticket. And a lot of what happened in Bonn was ticket balancing. And an enormous amount of credit has to go to Lakhdar Brahimi, who was the UN special negotiator for Afghanistan. He had a number of Afghan and American and other advisors that helped him put together essentially a balanced ticket. And it's a kind of pan-Afghan vision that we haven't seen in the past, certainly in the past 20, 30 years, and I think it bodes very well for the future of the country. And certainly there's a number of groups that are eager and willing to put money into Afghanistan. I have one concern, I don't know if we want to get into it now, that is the future of American policy in the region. But for the moment, I think I would be more than cautiously optimistic. I'd be very optimistic that this group can pull off the resuscitation of Afghanistan as a normal country.
The one in what I have now been reading, there are questions raised about whether individuals who had been players before but were not going to be part of this interim government, and two names that Mubin mentioned, Mr. Rabbani, who at one time had been president, and the commander, this man Abdul Sayyaf, questions about whether they could upset things because they were cut out of the process. Is it your feeling, indeed, as you said, that their era really is done, and it would not be possible for them to come along and make trouble for the new government?
I think the era is gone for many reasons. I'm not going to go through all of them, for religious, for policy, and others. So they tried to. These are, after all, educated people. Sayyaf and Rabbani both have master degrees from Al-Azhar University. They are not illiterate and imbecilic like Mullah Omar and some of the Taliban. I mean, so these are, but they tried to implement, I think, some form of government that lived to their ideology. But I think it was mostly torpedoed by the neighbors in 1993 and after that by Pakistan and Iran and many others. So the Taliban came in, and this was another form of a very, very clownish, savage, portrayed Islam as being clownish and savage and brutal and civil. And that one, of course, didn't work, because the idea to go back to the 7th century and 6th century and implement the Islamic law clearly failed here in the 21st century. So that both of these really came from different era, it looks like it, to people like Fahim Abdullah Abdullah or Karzai. Hamid Karzai has 7 brothers and 1 sister, and have some interest in restaurant and work here in the United States. Mm-hmm. His father was Abdulahad Karzai, who was a senator, and he was one of the very, very strong backer of the king. And after the king of Daoud Khan, he was the Speaker of the House in Afghanistan, who backed the candidacy of Mohammed Daoud in 1973. His father got killed, I think, 2 years ago in Quetta in Pakistan allegedly by Taliban. And many, many people believe that Taliban and Mullah Omar killed him. So he has both a personal as well as, I'm sure, a very, very deep love for the country. And he has a master's degree in political science, I should say, from India. So, and he speaks English and Pashto and Dari as well as Urdu.
Let me raise another question, and that is the question of the future of the Taliban leadership. There was yesterday some quotes from Mr. Karzai saying that if Mullah Omar was willing to renounce terrorism, that he would essentially be allowed to live out his life. And the quote was, live in dignity. Now, today there are quotes saying, well, if we find him, we'll arrest him. There seems to be a lot of uncertainty about what might happen to him. And, of course, the United States has said they don't think that he should simply be allowed to go free, and that if the new government in Afghanistan does that, the United States will be very unhappy. What do you think now will happen with the Taliban leadership? He's deferring to you, Steve.
Well, a question I have is there a price on Mullah Omar's head? Is there a reward for his capture? Mobin, do you know that? I know there is certainly on...
There is on Osama bin Laden.
Osama bin Laden, but... I think that if there is a price, then he will probably not be turned over alive. He'll just be turned over dead, and or else somebody may find the lamppost that they hung previous Afghan leaders from, and string him up there. I think that I wouldn't want to predict what his fate is going to be, but I think it would be best if the Afghans sort of locked him up in a monastery somewhere, or the Islamic equivalent of a monastery, and just let him alone. But I'm not sure whether the revenge factor may be very important for some of them.
If there is any, well, one can always. People who want to put a price on him, but apparently people don't think that he's worth it. So, but I think there might have been some sort of horse trading between Mullah Naqibullah in Gul Agha in Karzai. In this situation, it's quite possible that Mullah Omar simply vanishes. I mean, he's just killed, or so that solves the problem for many people, I presume. But I am very, very skeptical that Mullah Omar simply vanishes in Afghanistan. After all, I'm skeptical that anybody else can vanish in Afghanistan with all the knowledge that the Pakistan intelligence have had on them, and all the people that presumably the American forces have captured and interviewed over these weeks in Afghanistan. So it shouldn't be too difficult to find where the man is if he's alive.
Let me take a moment here to introduce again our two guests. Here in the studio with me is Mubin Shuresh. He is Emeritus Professor of Education Policy Studies at University of Illinois. And joining us from Washington, D.C. is Stephen Cohen, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution. We're talking about recent events in Afghanistan. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I want to, and particularly I think that this is something that Stephen Cohen will be able to talk about, have you talk a little bit about, to the extent that you know, how people in Pakistan are looking at what's happened. It seems that publicly they're supportive of what has happened, but privately they're still not happy about the fact that the Northern Alliance is in the interim government, has important posts, in spite of the fact that Mr. Karzai is a Pashtun and will be the prime minister. How does this all sit with folks in Afghanistan? I mean, pardon me, in Pakistan?
Yeah, David, I think that the Pakistanis, now we're really talking about the Pakistani elite. We're not talking about the general Pakistani population, who couldn't care one way or another about these things, except that they've suddenly had a lot of Afghan refugees coming into the country, competing with them for jobs. I think that Pakistan has been forced, literally with a not literally but figuratively with a gun pointed at its head, to reverse one of its major foreign policies, one of the pillars of its foreign policy, which was to use Afghanistan as to turn Afghanistan into a dependency and use Afghanistan as a jumping-off point for a policy extension of Pakistani influence into Central Asia. Pakistan was trying to play the great game of the British Empire. And that would be okay in a sense, but Pakistan wasn't British India. Pakistan didn't have the resources, the depth, the military economic power to play this kind of game. And furthermore, Pakistan in the past several years has been in a state of economic collapse. So I think that while Pakistani strategists some of them may be complaining about the reversals of their fortune in Afghanistan, many of them, and I think many of the more sensible Pakistanis, realize that this forcibly gets rid of a big burden around Pakistan's neck. I would compare it in some ways, an analogy, not exact perhaps, but an analogy to the period when Pakistan lost East Pakistan. After East Pakistan was stripped from Pakistan, privately, many Pakistanis actually welcomed this event because East Pakistan was a drag on the West Pakistani economy. And this may, I think, that's the analogy I would draw in the case of Afghanistan. And Pakistan really couldn't be a normal state as long as it had these grand imperial objectives in Afghanistan. The big question in Pakistan is whether the Pakistan government will continue to pursue a forward policy, an aggressive policy vis-a-vis India and Kashmir. And here you have a mixed bag of facts, but I don't want to get into the Kashmir issue at this point, but it's certainly a major calculation of the Pakistanis.
When the military action started, there was this concern that the Pakistani support for the United States would be destabilizing for the government of Pakistan, and that because there certainly were Pakistanis that were very unhappy that Pakistan was in any way, shape, or form cooperating with the United States. Is that still a concern?
No, that turns out to be the big lie there, that the Pakistan government always argued that the TINA factor, there is no alternative, and this is an argument that the civilian politicians used with regard to the military. It's an argument the military has used vis-a-vis the Islamic extremists, that there is no alternative to the government in power. Well, it turns out that by clamping down on the Islamists, the extreme Islamists, the Pakistan government is actually more popular, and General Musharraf's popularity has increased in Pakistan, not decreased. So I think it's demonstrated conclusively that the strength of the Islamic radicals in Pakistan is much, much weaker than anybody had thought. It really reflects their voting percentage, which was never more than 3 to 5%. So I think that we can hold Pakistan to a pretty high standard of domestic politics, and that they should be clamping down on Islamic extremists in their own country.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that? Ann Urbana on our line number one.
Hi.
Yes.
Oh, excuse me. This is sort of related to all of what you're speaking about, you know, when you talk about the future. The New York Times had an article recently about the is it cocaine or heroin?
It's a heroin.
Heroin from poppies, and how farmers are already beginning to replant this, and it's an enormous part of the economy, as I understood it. Will that affect anything as we go into the future? It seemed to me it kind of important.
Well, but people will grow poppies for opium because you can get 100 times more in the price than getting wheat.
That's what it said.
So the best thing is for the foreign assistant that goes to Afghanistan to create alternative crops or subsidize some of these farmers who live just at the edge and try to get some sustenance out of growing opium. So during the Taliban taxed the opium quite excessively, and they lived off it. But I think there's no problem. Turkey abandoned it, and there are many, many other countries who abandoned, including Iran, abandon opium growing because they find alternatives for farmers to do their living off.
So it may have been overstated then in that Times article.
No. In fact, during the Taliban rule, more than I heard about 70% of all the opium came from Afghanistan.
That's what. Yeah. Well, okay. Thanks. I thought it was just another factor that was important to look at. Mm.
And let me would add to sure. Mobin's answer that it is important, and I was at a meeting yesterday with a group of Afghan and other specialists. They're not quite sure whether the planting has increased in Afghanistan recently. This will be an important task for the new Afghan government to deal with. And to deal with it, they're going to have a military force of some sort or another. And the international relief and rescue operations are going to have to devote some resources to preventing the planting of poppies and the harvesting in the form of heroin. So I think that this is an issue that this concerns especially the some of Afghanistan's neighbors, Iran and Pakistan. But also it's very important to the Europeans, because I think something like 80% of their hard narcotics comes from Afghanistan.
Right, that's the important thing. Right. Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think certainly one of the things we know about Afghanistan today is it's a country with a highly armed populace. There are guns everywhere, and that simple sort of day-to-day security, peace on the streets, seems to be a quite a significant issue. I think, Steve, and I read a transcript of a meeting that you had there at Brookings when you and some other people were talking and talked about the fact that here we have – everybody's got a gun in this country, but there's no army. So there are various kinds of security issues here. You have to think about the security of the country, but then also, as I said, in a sense, sort of day-to-day peace. How does one meet that need?
But this is a myth, of course, because during the war, with the Soviet Union, people were armed. But historically, the only people that kept armed were in the northwest frontier, that's the no man's land between Afghanistan and Pakistan, mostly because of the trade. These are the people who make replicas of any kind of gun in the world, presumably, and that's part of the trade. But the rest of the Afghans they had gun, maybe one in the house, but like here in the United States, people would not go around with guns in their pockets or rifle on their shoulders. They did not. And I've never seen anywhere in Afghanistan that people were armed except after 1979, 1978 invasion by the former Soviet Union. So this is one of them. And the TV and the news show the Afghans, among other, they do not show the many of the aspects of this country that is not only fractured, but people are just normally distributed like anywhere else, miserable people, and destitute, as well as those that do all sort of crime and all sort of good things too. So being armed all the time hasn't been a tradition in Afghanistan. It is one of the folklore of the Pashtuns, some of the Pashtuns, not the Kandahar Pashtuns, who have been settled for hundreds of years, but some of the Pashtuns who are nomadic and some who lives in, like in the Wazir and around the, and parts of the this area that we are talking about Melwa and Tora Bora and this area, or the Khust, there are some people are armed because there is no government.
Do you think that concern is, am I overstating it, Steve?
I just learned a lot from Mobian. I was unaware of the differential level of arms in Afghanistan, and as is usual, Mobian Shoresh has taught me a lot about Afghanistan, and I certainly accept that, and I'm going to make further it shapes some of my thinking about the future of Afghanistan.
Well, let's talk with another caller. This is again someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes, I have a question with respect to the Taliban. We know by now that it was a most repressive regime. Hopefully the past tense is appropriate here. But what about equating it with terrorism? Was the Taliban ever by itself a terrorist organization, or was it just a regime which allowed the Al-Qaeda to have a base? I think that distinction would be quite important, because I do believe that international definitions of terrorism wouldn't go that far than to portray Taliban as a terrorist organization.
Well, clearly Al-Qaeda, which incidentally means the base, was in Afghanistan. And even if one does not accept the United States allegation at the beginning that pointed the finger to Al-Qaeda, we know now by all the documents that have been found in Afghanistan, in Kabul, in Jalalabad, and elsewhere, of the presence of Al-Qaeda and its involvement in all form of mischievous terror. But so that after a while, and I think it, for many, many months, the Al-Qaeda, I believe, was running Afghanistan for various reasons that I did not want to go through with it, that it became almost impossible how to distinguish between Al-Qaeda and Taliban, because Taliban officials from the cabinet all the way to Mullah Omar deferred slavishly to the Al-Qaeda officials. So that, my major complaint, of course, aside from the 9/11 horrific things that happened here in the United States, has been the murder and killing of the Afghan innocent by the Taliban and also by Al-Qaeda group. These are native Afghans that did not agree with these folks, and they killed them brutally and murdered innocent people, beheading them, like among the Hazara in Yakawalang, elsewhere. Because of this, I think that Al-Qaeda, as well as the Taliban officials, should stay in trial and be brought to justice. And they are terrorists.
Steve, you want to add anything?
Well, the definition of terrorism is still vague, and there's no real international accepted definition of it. But I think the Taliban, by allowing and in fact encouraging the Al-Qaeda to operate from their country, really were culpable. And secondly, they did terrorize their own population and in many ways. But beyond them were the Pakistanis and the Saudis, and I think that this is a secondary layer of guilt. But I view the Taliban as really sort of simple, ignorant, badly educated peasants who were led astray by a pseudo charismatic leader. But really, the backbone was provided by the Pakistanis and by Saudis, and that creates other problems for us, much larger foreign policy problems that this administration is going to have to deal with, especially in the case of the Saudis.
Could I still add to it?
Yes.
I hope I didn't create the impression that I'm sympathetic to Taliban. I was interested in whether per se it ever was a terrorist organization, because the moment court cases do come up, it doesn't matter wherever they take place, the courts will have to prove that Taliban was a terrorist organization. This is my basic question. They may have been sympathizers. They may have actually accepted the orders of Al-Qaeda. But was it in itself a terrorist activity? Because that is going to be the basic question in any kind of court situation.
Well, let me ask the caller, where do you think these trials are going to take place?
Well, I don't know. I presume that if one can believe the situation, then they may take place in Afghanistan. I think that's clearly the objective of the interim government when it's going to be in place, that Taliban is not going to be handed over to the USA. I don't think that they can internally afford that. No, actually, would I say might it be such a wise move? I think it would be great if Afghanistan could show the world that it's capable of implementing justice on its own territory. So for all these reasons, I think presumably it could take place in Afghanistan. And then was the question, yes, was Taliban ever organized as a terrorist organization or just a sympathizing organization?
I think the Afghans are capable of establishing and creating field courts. Equivalent of what's called here the military commissions. They're very easy to do, and I'm sure they can bring to justice these people in Afghanistan.
I'm going to jump in here, and I hope the caller will forgive me. I have two other people who are holding, and we're moving into our last 15 minutes. I'd like to give some other callers a chance as well to talk with our guests. Mubin Shuresh, he is an emeritus professor of education policy studies at University of Illinois and has been following events in Afghanistan for a long, long time. And Steve Cohen is here as well. He's a senior fellow, or he's with us, not here in the studio, but he's in Washington, D.C. He's a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies program at the Brookings Institution and was, for a number of years, professor of political science here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana listeners. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Crystal Lake, and that's line 4.
Yes.
Hello? Yes.
Hi. It seems unclear how closely connected bin Laden was to the Taliban government, but they did protect them at least. And while we know that Afghanistan under the Taliban is very repressive, Osama, connected to that, Osama bin Laden didn't like the Saudi Arabian government, which is also oppressive, just as oppressive, and women have second-class status. And all the money goes to the Saudi Arabian princes, of which there are about 6,000. But it doesn't go to the oil money doesn't go to the public welfare. Things are distributed it to the Saudi Arabian people at all, very negligibly. And if you get in trouble with the prince, the Saudi Arabian's royalty, they in dissent, there is no allowed dissent. They're very repressive. They knock off your arm or something. But the thing is, the Saudi Arabian, like keep their government closely attached to the United States because the United States wants to get reasonably priced oil. And for this oil, which we guzzle here, we support a very repressive government just as bad as the Taliban in Afghanistan. So I think if our oil interests, like in Bush and Cheney, have very close connection to the oil in Saudi Arabia, too, I think there would be less repressive governments and a chance at the democracies there instead of so many people going poor, that I think we should, if we're going to proclaim the Afghanistan is repressive under the Taliban, and it is, so it is in, likewise in Saudi Arabia also, that we can get cheap oil. And I wonder, there was talk of a pipeline across Afghanistan, but the United States oil companies, which are very powerful, they control. They like to get this oil. And Colombia also is a war not just over drugs; it's also over oil too.
You've made a number of very good points. So, Betty, in fact, I want to make sure I give the guests a chance to respond. Steve, you want to pick up on that?
Let me answer the questions pertinent, not perhaps not in, this, in the order in which they're asked. But first of all, two factual points. In Saudi Arabia, there is, in effect, a welfare state, and there's not much poverty in Saudi Arabia. There's also not much creative work going on in that country, but the average Saudi citizen does get his education or her education paid for, and often abroad, and comprehensive medical care. The problem is that the government is running out of money, and while certainly the princes, and it's a huge royal family, do very well, there's a tension, I think, between the royalty and other Saudis. There's also other factions in Saudi Arabia, but it's not a poor country, although it's squandered some of its money. Secondly, the pipeline that might go across Afghanistan wouldn't be an oil pipeline, it would be a gas pipeline, and it would come from either Iran or possibly from Central Asia. And this has been opposed by the United States, the Iran version of this, because of our hostility towards Iran. My hope is that the Bush administration will change their mind about and allow this kind of pipeline to go through, because it would be tremendous benefit to off the Afghans for transit rights, and also to Pakistan. The real consumer of that gas would be India, not the United States. India is an energy deficit country. It desperately needs this kind of fairly cheap energy. The larger point you make about oil and dependency, I think, is exactly correct, and I have no problem with your argument. But I wouldn't blame the Bush administration, either this one or the father's administration, even though there are a lot of oil people in both of them. I think that the Clinton people did as much as anybody else to make us more addicted to oil. And every time you see a sports utility vehicle trundling down the road, getting 7 miles per gallon, you know, that's why we're addicted to oil. And the oil has to come from the Saudis or from the Iraqis. We don't want to buy from the Iraqis, so there's not much. In the Middle East, that's our major source.
I just want to add that at the beginning of the Taliban, UNICAL of California, in Delta of Saudi Arabia, these oil companies and some other breed of Argentina, they did try to build a pipeline through Afghanistan. And the Taliban originally was, in fact, to create this, help this pipeline and foster unfettered free trade. So, but U.S. was involved and backed it, and many people in the State Department, including Robin Raphael and others, did push for this pipeline, but then Afghanistan was at war and it didn't work. So the lady is right. Oil is always in the bottom of some of these things.
All right. I thank the caller. Let's continue. Next is Urbana, line number 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Is this number 2?
Yes.
Thank you. Hi, Movin. Hi, Steve. This is Badruddin.
Hi, Badruddin.
Basically, I'd like to hear your comments on a recent book that was published in France by two journalists describing the relationship between the U.S. government and the Taliban on the oil issue and so on and so forth. But the key point, I guess, was that the accusation in the book. And these people rely on their interview with an FBI agent who was working on the case of terrorism in Afghanistan and the Al-Qaeda and so on. And then this FBI person was hampered in his efforts to continue the the investigation of the Qaeda before, well before the September 11th, because of the oil deal that was supposedly being worked out with the Taliban and so on. Then this person was forced to resign from the FBI, and he went to work for a security agency in the World Trade Center, and he was killed there after September 11th. I mean, on September 11th. But the point in the book is that there's a lot of accusation against the U.S. government of hampering the investigation of terrorism in Afghanistan, especially the Qaeda group, because of the oil deal. I would like to hear your comments both on this, and I just hang up. Thank you.
All right.
That's the first I've heard of this. I've talked and worked with some senior officials in the Clinton administration, and everything I've heard from them is that we were extremely active in trying to find out and do something about the linkage between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And from their perspective, oil was not a factor. I think at the operational level, the National Security Council and so forth, this was not a significant issue. A book based on one interview with a dead FBI agent, I think, is I would question the reliability of the source. But I'm not saying it couldn't be true, though.
But I haven't read the book because I cannot read French. But Badruddin, I think there is no argument regarding the United States encouraging this pipeline early in the 90s. And many Talibans were hosted and dined. I'm sure they were not wined by the UNICAL in the United States and tried to put this pipeline through. And I still think it's a good project now that Afghanistan will be in peace.
Let's continue. Another caller. This is Champagne, and it's line one. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Yes.
I just make one quick comment about oil, and that is that if we paid anywhere close to what everyone else in the world pays for gas, we might see some searches for alternative energy and a change in our policy. But since we scream every time the price goes up above $1.10, those policies are never going to change. But my question is, I have heard early on it seemed like India had a more of a role in the whole process with Afghanistan, but I haven't heard a lot lately. And I was just wondering if the speakers could comment on the fact that it seems like Iran and a number of other countries in the region are part of this process, which will look to see what happens with Afghanistan and the government. And it seems to me that a lot of the Pashto or Pathan or Taliban fighters who may have or may still yet flee to Pakistan may find homes in insurgency movements in Kashmir, which is going to make India extremely uncomfortable. More so because it doesn't seem, or I may have missed this, but it doesn't seem that the U.S. Certified some of the Kashmiri movements as terrorist movements. And please correct me if I'm wrong, but I'd be interested to see what you think of where India stands right now and what's going to happen in the near future in terms of that development. Thanks.
Well, this is definitely Steve Cohen's
area. One of the terrorist organizations was listed as a terrorist organization recently by the State Department, and the U.S. ambassador to India was asked about this, and he said, just wait, it will happen soon with regard to another one. So I think that the U.S. is beginning to move to label some of these groups as terrorists, which they have been for some time. It's a delicate issue because we still are dependent on Pakistan's support for dealing with Afghanistan. And Pakistan was really part of the problem in that it was one of the founding fathers of the Taliban and sustained them over the years. But Pakistan is also part of the solution in that the U.S. can't operate against the Taliban without Pakistani assistance. And hopefully we're going to get Pakistan to reverse some of its policies in Kashmir. The Indian perspective on Afghanistan really derives from two factors. One is a view that India itself inherited the grand strategic role of British India, and that Afghanistan, Central Asia, are really parts of the Indian sphere of influence. And the other view is that Afghanistan must be supported in kind of a balance of power policy to encircle Pakistan. And I think this probably is more important than the first. Pakistanis in particular are paranoid about Indian presence in Afghanistan. And the Indians, of course, point out that they've been in Afghanistan. They've had part of their culture comes from Afghanistan. So it takes us back to the basic India-Pakistan dispute, which is, this isn't the program to do it on, but which is, I think, one of the major danger points of the world today.
Well, I think that you've more than once, and I'm sure before, you've made the point that this is an important issue, something that the United States and other countries really need to pay attention to. And it's because it is a possible flashpoint, very dangerous. It's it shouldn't simply be allowed to fester. You know, we should be doing something about it.
You know, I think we should do something before there's a war. You know, the American humorist Ambrose Bierce has written that God invented war so that Americans might learn about geography. And we've learned about Vietnam, we've learned about Cambodia, we've learned about Bosnia, Serbia, you name it, we've learned about Afghanistan. This is the hard way to learn about the world, and I would hope that University of Illinois, the schools in Urbana and Champaign begin to teach geography to their students so we know about the world before there's a war, not after there's a war.
One other point here. We have a couple of minutes left and we haven't talked very much about it. There now is discussion of some kind of international force for Afghanistan to do relief, to do rebuilding, to do peacekeeping. And it seems, though, at the moment that's rather up in the air exactly what shape the force will take, who will participate, and so forth.
I think that there should be some force. The Northern Alliance, of course, has now all the assets and the soldiers all over the country, simply to give some form of assurances for some of these cabinet ministers that comes in from outside of Afghanistan to take their post, and that's one of their requests. And I think there should be a modest international force, preferably drawn from Indonesia, Bangladesh, maybe Iran, Pakistan. Not Pakistan at this moment, but
Turkey.
Turkey, yes.
Yeah. You think it would be important that these are
I
other...
So. Psychologically, I think it would be nice.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Let me add something to this discussion. There's a big debate going on now within the Washington Beltway about what should happen in the Afghan Beltway. You know, there's this ring road in Afghanistan. And I think that one of the things that dismays me is that this administration, especially the Department of Defense, is very much against an international peace corps, peacekeeping force. And they've discouraged the European allies, especially the Canadians and the Canadians and the Germans and so from really getting involved in Afghanistan, because the major reason is that if a European or an international force were to get in trouble, then the U.S. would have to spare some time and effort to get rid of it. They want to keep this a solely American operation. I can see that being valuable from an operational perspective, but I think from a strategic and political perspective, it's a very serious mistake. Hopefully, the U.S. government will change its mind after we catch the Al Qaeda leadership and a few others and encourage and actually support a European plus non-Western peacekeeping force for Afghanistan.
Mm. Well, for that, for the moment, we will have to stop because we've used the time. Stephen Cohen, thank you very much.
Very good to be with you
again. For being with us again. Sure. Stephen Cohen is Foreign Policy Studies in the Foreign Policy Studies Program at the Brookings Institution, Washington, D.C. His most recent book, by the way, if you're interested in reading about India, is Emerging Power India, published by the Brookings Institution Press. And here in the studio with me, Mubin Shuresh, Emeritus Professor, Education Policy Studies, U of I. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Very much.
Goodbye.